Yep.
I had the privilege of being a violist in, I think, approximately 10 performances of your fourth string quartet.
Oh, yes.
And incidentally, I want to thank you for letting the viola start.
I have a good rhythm, don't you know?
It always gave me a feeling of great responsibility because if the tempi were not correct, then guess who got blamed for it?
Anyway, how important the tempo is.
Anyway, about, I think, 8 of those performances were in the British Isles and in Europe, and very often the press and audience said that they felt that you as being an American Bartok.
Oh, well, that's a great compliment. I admire Bartok very much.
I mean, I think the rhythmic drive of the, particularly the opening movement and whatnot, probably led them to. Was there a period in your life when Bartok was in?
Oh, of course. Just as there was a period when Stravinsky and Bartok has been an enormously strong influence and would be bound to have been a strong influence on almost anybody writing for string quartet, and is perhaps even now a very strong influence because they've got to be careful not to do certain things. Because Bartok used that up. I mean, incidentally, though, I must say that not the fourth string quartet. The fourth string quartet, I knew the second Bartok string quartet at that time. You see, that was written, wasn't it, in the 40s?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the recordings, I think you'll discover that the recordings of Bartok took place in the very early 50s. And though I knew the string quartets, of course, let me modify that. I didn't have an awful lot of money, and even then, Bartok string quartets are expensive. Do you know how much? I wanted to analyze the second piano concerto with the students at Michigan this coming March. And do you know how much the miniature score cost? $26. Now, that's absurd. I just can't do it. I'm just not going to do it. I'll do it in a different way. I'll make them analyze it with their ears without looking at it. This is a dreadful thing for me to say, Don, but it is an awful high price. Just awful. But even in the 40s, I didn't have an awful lot of money, and Bartok scores were a little hard to come by. So I knew some of them. Now, what ones? The second I knew very well. I had heard the second a great deal, and I think one might suspect that it had had an influence on that work. Don't you think? I am very fond of the second quartet. It has a kind of a motor rhythm that I like. I don't have any idea what influences there were on. Did you ever guess where I began writing that quartet? Well, a composer almost never starts composing a thing right at the beginning. You know, I mean, that isn't, you almost never do. It was in the middle of the slow movement, the viola. That was where the impetus of the work started. And then I knew perfect. I didn't write the slow movement then, but I knew that. I wrote that, and then I went. And one might have guessed the ending, the epigraph at the end. I wish I had heard you. I'd love to hear a tape of it.
Professor Finney, midway in your teaching career, you made a statement that I wonder if you can look back on it now from the perspective of further time. He said, there's always the problem that the creative force of the composer and the analytical force of the professor may conflict. The analytic process may be stultifying, but I'm not worried about that. You made the statement in an interview that I had with you when I was at Michigan 23 years ago.
Now, frankly, I think I agree with that homework. Read it again. What did I say?
By the way, the story won an award that year, too. There's always the problem that the creative force of the composer and the analytical force of the professor may conflict. The analytic process may be stultifying, but I'm not worried about that.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good statement. I kind of like that. what I meant to say by that is that there is a danger when you take an enthusiastic student who really thinks that he can just give him just a little time and he's going to be a second Bartok, you know, overnight practically. And maybe he doesn't have to bother about finding out how Beethoven wrote, say, the beginning of 59 number 3, which is such an incredible miracle. And to speak to this composer, to make this composer analyze, he may think that you're going to destroy something for him in his enthusiasm. My feeling is, as I think I said earlier in this talk, I don't think you can ever destroy the creative impulse by theoretical study. I don't think it necessarily follows that theoretical study is going to improve the creative impulse. But I think there's a big enough chance that it might, that it's worth giving it a pretty good chance. It may be a did I see Doug come after that?
That's going to have a job in the morning.
I come back to the capital investment of a few notes. I mean, certainly I couldn't have dealt with that situation if somebody hadn't helped me in the theory of music. I must admit, Alban Berg, when he made me analyze the Schoenberg, he never told me he didn't ever look at it again. Maybe this is a kind of a good theory teaching. He said, do this, and his attitude was, if you don't do it, why, it's your loss. I couldn't care less. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe the student should just realize that he's the loser if he doesn't learn how to cope with notes. But I must admit that I find notes interesting. And the curious ways that they go together and the sounds they make, I find interesting. And that's theory.